Lecture 7, Differences in Emotional Experience.
As we have seen, people differ in their general tendencies to experience positive and negative emotions. In this lecture, we're going to talk about the fact that in addition to the general tendency to feel good and bad, people also differ in the degree to which they experience specific emotions. For any emotion that you can think of, anger, joy, guilt, anxiety, resentment, jealousy, or sadness, or whatever, people differ in how often they feel that emotion, as well as how intensely they feel it. These tendencies to experience particular emotions are an important part of personality. I might tend to feel angry and disappointed and hurt, and you might be more inclined to feel anxious and sad. And these differences in our favorite emotions make us different kinds of people. To understand why certain people experience particular emotions more than other people do, we have to consider two things. We have to know something about the causes of each specific emotion. And then we need to identify characteristics that predispose certain people to respond more frequently or intensely to those causes. As we discussed previously, all emotions are fundamentally responses to perceived threats and opportunities. And if that's true, then specific emotions must be about specific kinds of threats or opportunities. The most widely accepted theory of emotion in psychology suggests that each emotion is evoked by a particular perception or interpretation, what psychologists call a cognitive appraisal. As we go through each day, we are constantly appraising or assessing the implications of the events we experience for our personal concerns. We're continually asking ourselves, how is this situation or this other person's behavior or this event likely to affect my outcomes or my well-being? Now, we obviously don't go through life consciously asking ourselves, how does this event affect me? How does that affect me? What about that thing over there? But our brains are designed to assess how things are going on an ongoing basis, rather automatically. And when your brain detects a possible threat or challenge or a possible opportunity or benefit, it gets your attention and says, hey, here's something that you need to pay attention to. So according to the cognitive appraisal theory, the emotion that you experience depends on how you cognitively appraise the situation, how you assess its implications for you. So for example, if you appraise a situation as posing a threat to your safety, you'll experience fear. But if you appraise a situation as involving the loss of something that's important to you, loss of a relationship, loss of a prized possession, or even loss of a person, you'll feel sad. If your appraisal is, I did something bad, then you'll feel guilty. And if you perceive that someone or something is unjustifiably blocking a goal that you have, you'll experience anger, and so on. Thinking of emotions as the result of particular cognitive appraisals helps to explain why people's emotional experiences differ. I may tend to experience different emotions than you do because I tend to interpret the things I experience differently than you do. For example, I may tend to interpret events as threats to my well-being and be an anxious sort of person. You may tend to interpret events as unjustified barriers to your goals and experience anger a great deal. We could spend an entire course on the psychology of emotion, but what I want to do here is to look at just a few examples of personality differences that involve people's tendencies to experience particular emotions. And I'll start with social anxiety. Anxiety in general is caused by the appraisal that a threat of some kind may lie in your future. If the threat is right here, right now, we usually call the reaction fear. But there's really not much difference between reactions to a future threat, which we call anxiety, and a current threat, which we call fear. In any case, some people are obviously more anxious than others. Some people feel anxious a great deal of the time in many different situations, whereas other people rarely experience anxiety. This general tendency to experience anxiety is strongly related to neuroticism, as is the tendency to experience most negative emotions. But rather than talk about general anxiety, let's focus on anxiety that arises in one particular context, social interactions. All of us occasionally feel awkward and anxious in certain kinds of social situations, such as at parties where we don't know anybody, or when we're meeting new people, or when speaking up in a group meeting, or giving a talk, or performing in front of an audience. But some people experience social anxiety more often and more intensely than other people do. Some of us are terrified by the prospect of certain social encounters, and some of us are less bothered. And this personality difference has important implications for people's lives. But what are highly socially anxious people afraid of? Fundamentally, social anxiety arises from a concern about how one is being perceived and evaluated by other people. When we drill down to the common ingredient in all instances of social anxiety, we find that socially anxious people are concerned that other people might form an undesired impression of them or evaluate them negatively. As long as people think that they will make the kind of impression they would like to make, and thus be evaluated as they would like, they feel reasonably relaxed. But when they want others to see them in some desired way, as competent or smart or attractive or responsible or whatever, and don't think they're going to be seen that way, they experience social anxiety. So the personal characteristics that make some people especially prone to social anxiety fall into two categories. One category involves attributes that lead people to be highly concerned with other people's impressions and evaluations of them. Of course, everybody is concerned with what other people think of them from time to time, and that's fine. In fact, it's essential. But people who are unusually motivated to make desired impressions are more likely to experience social anxiety. So, for example, people who are simply more attuned to how they are coming across to other people worry more about how others view them. People differ in how much they think about how they're coming across to others. This personality characteristic is called public self-consciousness, and it involves how aware you are of the fact that other people are observing you. Some people think about their public persona a great deal, and other people are pretty oblivious to the fact that other people are evaluating them at all. And the more that you think about your public image, the higher you are in public self-consciousness, the more likely you are to be socially anxious. And people who are not only aware of being perceived and evaluated, but who are also worried about others evaluating them unfavorably, people who are high in the trait of fear of negative evaluation, are even more likely to be high in social anxiety. Given that social anxiety arises from a concern with other people's impressions and evaluations, people who are more attuned to and concerned about their impressions will experience social anxiety more often. The second category of characteristics that can make people anxious in social situations involves the degree to which they think they can make the kinds of impressions on others that they would like to make. So people's judgments of their own social skills predict their tendency to be socially anxious. If you think that you have really good social skills that allow you to make desired impressions wherever you go, you probably won't be prone to social anxiety. But if you question your social skills, if you don't think you're a good conversationalist or an interesting person, or that you can talk to anybody about anything, you're more likely to doubt that you'll make the impressions you want to make, and you'll be more likely to experience social anxiety. People with lower self-esteem also tend to be higher in social anxiety for much the same reason. People who are higher in self-esteem think that they have more socially valued characteristics and that they are more accepted by other people. So they assume that they make better impressions than low self-esteem people do. And on average, they feel less socially anxious. So we can trace differences in people's tendency to experience a particular emotion, such as social anxiety, to personality characteristics that predispose them to respond to the kind of appraisals that elicit that emotion. In this case, characteristics related to concerns with one's social impressions. While we're talking about social anxiety, let me mention a closely related characteristic, just because I think it's interesting. And that's embarrassability. How easily people get embarrassed. Of course, everybody gets embarrassed now and then. The question is, how often and how easily do you get embarrassed? It takes a lot to embarrass some people, whereas other people get embarrassed very easily. The personality scales that are used to measure embarrassability ask people to rate how embarrassed they would feel in many different situations. So for example, how embarrassed would you be, say on a 1 to 5 scale, if you spilled a bowl of tomato soup all over yourself at a fancy dinner party? Or a group of friends sang happy birthday to you in a restaurant? Man, I really feel bad when I see that happen to somebody. Or how embarrassed would you feel if you showed up at a social event to find that you were terribly underdressed, the only man without a coat and tie, or the only woman not wearing a dress? Or you walked into a bathroom at somebody else's house and discovered it was occupied by a member of the other sex. Oops. If you chose a rating of 4 or 5 for all or most of these situations, you're probably more embarrassable than the average person. Some people just shrug off these kinds of things, and other people are mortified. And the difference matters, because fear of embarrassment often prevents people from trying new things or taking social risks. People who are higher in embarrassability are more afraid of doing things in which they might be embarrassed, so it can put quite a constraint on people's behavior. Just as with social anxiety, embarrassability is higher among people who are afraid of being evaluated negatively. So people who are more motivated by a desire for social approval tend to become embarrassed more easily, as do those who are more motivated to avoid social rejection. Let's turn to a very different emotion, anger. Some people have a hair trigger as far as anger is concerned. It doesn't take much to set them off. Other people are very slow to get angry. And as with most traits, most of us fall somewhere in the middle. Researchers use the term hostility, and sometimes the term anger proneness, to refer to individual differences in the tendency to become angry. People who are high in hostility differ from those who are low in hostility on 2 interrelated reactions. Beyond simply becoming angry more often, hostile people also display a pattern of hostile thoughts and perceptions. People who are high in hostility tend to interpret other people's behavior as potentially hostile or threatening, even when it's not. So an important characteristic that distinguishes people who are high and low in hostility is how they interpret other people's actions. People who score higher in hostility show a bias to interpret other people's behaviors negatively. In addition, people who are high in hostility aren't just more angry, but they also have more aggressive urges. Some hostile people, probably those with low self-control, actually behave more aggressively. They strike out. They hurt other people. But even when they control their aggressive behaviors, hostile people often feel the urge to aggress. Fortunately, they don't always act on that urge, but hostile people often have to fight the action tendency that accompanies their anger. So we have a package of feelings, perceptions, and urges that reflect the dispositional tendency to become angry. Not surprisingly, people who are high in hostility have more negative interactions with other people than less hostile people do. Hostility poses a particularly serious problem in close relationships. People who are higher in hostility have more conflicts with their romantic partners, both because they interpret their partner's behaviors more negatively and because they're more likely to say critical and disparaging things that then evoke counter-reactions from the partner. Their negativity and irritability lead other people to react negatively, so they create an upward spiral of angry reactions in their partners and in other people. And not only do they have more conflicts with other people, but their conflicts are more likely to spill over to new situations. They tend to harbor grudges and carry resentment. So once they are mad about one thing, situations can escalate. In light of the impact of hostility on people's relationships, it's not surprising that studies of newlyweds show that marriage satisfaction declines more rapidly among people who have hostile partners. Hostility also contributes to people's health problems. Most notably, dispositional hostility is associated with high blood pressure and the risk of coronary heart disease. Not only are hostile people more likely to get heart disease, but they live a shorter amount of time after they're initially diagnosed. So here we have a personality trait that is actually a risk factor for health problems and mortality. Several things contribute to this link between hostility and heart problems. Because they're more likely to appraise situations in ways that make them angry, hostile people live with more negative emotion and more stress on a daily basis. And even when they're not overtly angry, people higher in hostility tend to simmer with underlying irritability. All of this stress and emotional arousal has negative physiological consequences. Blood pressure remains high, and chronic stress exposes people to elevated levels of stress hormones, such as adrenaline and cortisol, which can affect the circulatory system, change the way that blood clots form, and increase the risk of having a heart attack. And because their hostility tends to undermine the quality of their relationships and even drive people away, hostile people forfeit the support and the goodwill that people normally get from their close relationships. Given that happy, supportive relationships lower stress and promote better physical health, hostile people can lose out on things that might normally buffer them against the negative effects of stress. In everyday language, people often use the words guilt and shame interchangeably, but they are actually distinct emotions. And people who tend to experience a lot of guilt are somewhat different in terms of their personality from people who tend to experience shame. Now, obviously, guilt and shame both involve reactions to engaging in some sort of undesirable or bad behavior. The difference between them involves how people think about what they did. In the case of guilt, people focus on the bad behavior and the harm that it caused. But in the case of shame, the focus is on what a bad person I am for having done whatever I did. People feel guilty about behaving in a certain way, but they feel ashamed of themselves as a person for what they did. So the same behavior can elicit either guilt or shame, depending on how the person appraises it. It seems like a small matter whether I focus on my bad behavior or on my bad self, but it makes a big difference in how people react when they do bad things. Consider a behavior such as hurting another person's feelings. If you feel guilty about hurting the person, you're likely to mull it over and to feel badly, but mostly you'll be motivated to make up for it in some way by apologizing and making amends. When you're guilty, your focus is on the behavior and undoing the harm that you caused. But if you feel ashamed after hurting someone's feelings, you're likely to ruminate about what a bad person you are for behaving in such a way, and you'll probably feel small and worthless. And instead of trying to fix the problem you caused, you're more inclined to withdraw from the situation and avoid the person you hurt. When people are ashamed, they focus on themselves and how awful they are instead of trying to fix things. And we can really see the difference between guilt and shame when we look at personality differences between people who tend to experience guilt, we'll call them guilt-prone people, and people who tend to experience shame, shame-prone people. Although some of the same characteristics that lead people to be prone to feeling guilty also lead people to feel ashamed, studies have shown that guilt-proneness and shame-proneness are sufficiently different to be considered two different personality characteristics. They're separate traits, and people can score low to high on each one. So a person could be low in both guilt-proneness and shame-proneness, high in both, or low in one and high in the other. One thing that distinguishes guilt-prone from shame-prone people is their capacity for empathy, the ability to take other people's perspectives and to feel badly when other people suffer. People who tend to feel guilty are higher in empathy than those who don't feel guilty very much, whereas there's no relationship whatsoever between shame proneness and how empathic people are. Guilt-prone people also tend to take greater responsibility for their actions. Shame-prone people show a paradoxical pattern in which behaving badly leads them to focus on what a bad and worthless person they are, yet they tend to become angry and blame other people as well. This seems inconsistent, but it might be a way for shame-prone people to deal with their negative views of themselves. It's painful to think of yourself as a bad person, so shame-prone people sometimes shift the blame to others. For many years, psychologists assumed that both guilt and shame help to deter bad behavior. The idea was that both experiences are so painful that people should try not to do things that make them feel guilty or ashamed. But research has shown that only guilt seems to have this effect. People who are highly prone to guilt are less likely to engage in immoral and illegal actions than those who are less guilt-prone, as we would expect. If you feel guilty a lot, you're less likely to do bad things that hurt other people. But the tendency to experience shame is not related to more moral behavior. Shame-prone people don't behave any better than people who are not shame-prone. The tendency to experience shame is associated with a number of undesirable psychological symptoms as well. Shame-prone people tend to have lower self-esteem. They tend to be more depressed and anxious, and they also experience more stress. The tendency to experience guilt isn't consistently linked with these kinds of problems. So being high in guilt proneness is less problematic than being high in shame proneness. I'm going to close this lecture by saying a few things about a trait that doesn't involve experiencing a particular emotion, but rather has to do with how intensely a person experiences all emotions. Two people may experience the same emotions equally often, but one person's emotional reactions are consistently stronger than the other person's are. This personality variable, which is called affect intensity, was discovered in the 1980s when research showed that people who had the strongest positive moods on good days over several months also had the strongest negative moods on bad days. I'm not talking here about how often people experienced positive and negative emotions, but rather how strongly they felt whatever positive or negative emotions they experienced. The tendency to experience all emotions strongly versus weakly is itself a personality variable. So think of yourself. Do your emotions tend to be more intense than those of most people? To what extent can you remain calm even on the most trying days? Would your friends say that you're high-strung? Are your moods mild or intense? Would people say that you're usually calm and cool? These are the sorts of questions that researchers use to measure affect intensity. In one study, researchers had people who had already completed a measure of affect intensity write down the most significant good thing and the most significant bad thing that happened to them every day for 8 weeks, and also rate their moods each day. Then they had many other people rate each of these descriptions of the good and bad events so that researchers could get an estimate of how good or bad the average person viewed each event that the participants reported. The data showed that at each level of goodness or badness, as rated by other participants, the participants who were high in affect intensity reported more extreme emotions. People with higher affect intensity felt better on days when good things happened, and they felt worse on days when bad things happened. Now, you might think, well, maybe people who are higher in affect intensity actually experience more extreme good and bad events, and that's a logical possibility. But analyses show that affect intensity wasn't related to the severity of the events themselves. People higher in affect intensity simply had stronger reactions to whatever happened. But why? As we have seen, emotions depend on how people think about things. And this is also true of how intensely people experience their emotions. People who are higher in affect intensity tend to personalize and generalize the things they experience more than people low in affect intensity do. By personalize, I mean that they interpret events that occur as being more relevant or important to them personally. The more people focus on the personal implications of the things that happen, the stronger their reactions are likely to be. People higher in affect intensity also tend to generalize the implications of events more than is warranted. Imagine getting a flat tire on the way to work. That's really frustrating, and just about everybody would have at least a mild negative reaction. Oh, geez, what a pain. But if you generalize beyond the frustration of the immediate event, and you start thinking of what else might happen, you'll have a stronger emotional response. If you start thinking about getting to work late and the possibility that your boss will be mad or a client will be upset or whatever, you'll have a stronger reaction to having a flat tire. Of course, those things might happen, but they probably won't. And by overgeneralizing the implications of having a flat tire, a person high in affect intensity will experience stronger negative emotions even if the dreaded events don't happen. One intriguing difference between people who are low and high in affect intensity involves their career choices. Some careers seem to attract people with higher versus lower affect intensity. For example, graduate students who are going into art versus science careers differ in affect intensity before they even start grad school. Art students score significantly higher in affect intensity than science students do. After all, a good part of art, whether we're talking about visual arts or music or theater or dance, is intended to evoke emotional reactions in people. So people who have stronger emotional reactions to things are more likely to gravitate towards such fields. In contrast, science is supposed to be rational and unemotional, so it suits people better who are lower in affect intensity. Affect intensity also has implications for how people react to advertisements. As you know, many ads use emotional appeals to get you to buy their product or donate to their cause. Look at how good you'll feel if you use this kind of shampoo or drink this brand of beer. Or we'll show you sad pictures of abandoned animals so that you'll donate to animal rescue. People who are higher in affect intensity are more responsive to advertisements that evoke good and bad emotions than people who are lower in affect intensity. One last question. Is affect intensity related to people's overall happiness? That is, who's happier? People who are low in affect intensity or those who are high in affect intensity? Research is pretty clear on this. There's no relationship whatsoever between affect intensity and happiness overall. I think that's because happiness reflects the proportion of positive and negative emotions that a person experiences over time. Happy people experience a higher ratio of positive to negative emotions than unhappy people do. Imagine we have two people, one of whom is low in affect intensity and the other is high in affect intensity. If they experience the same proportion of good to bad emotions, let's say 70% of their emotions are positive, they'll probably be equally happy overall. The person high in affect intensity will feel worse when things go badly and better when things go well, but the two people should be equally happy overall. As we've seen, people's tendencies to experience particular emotions and their tendency to experience them weakly or strongly are an important part of personality. Many differences among people reflect differences in their typical patterns of emotional experience. Furthermore, people experience emotions differentially because they possess traits that predispose them to respond more frequently or more intensely to situations that evoke those emotions. These differences are important because they help to explain why different people often respond to the same event in different ways. And these differences in people's emotional tendencies lead different people who have quite different kinds of lives.